beneath the bunk and pulled out a roll of brown canvas that was labeled Field First Aid. He unfurled it, revealing a variety of surgical instruments and containers strapped to the interior. A moment later, he was injecting something into Meg's arm. "What was that?" I asked, kneeling beside him. "Was that morphine?"
"Aye, a syringe. A preloaded syringe. I jostled her something fierce getting her in here, and I see no reason she shouldn't sleep through this."
He glanced back at me.
"I said get your mask on."
I was struggling with the straps when Angus twisted on his heels and did something to the back of my head. I reached up to investigate. He'd secured the place where the straps converged with a safety pin. Several aircraft screamed overhead, one after another. I shrieked and covered my head. Angus threw his arms around me, and I clutched him in a death grip, turning my face and digging the canister of my gas mask into his shoulder.
"Those are Spitfires, just Spitfires. There's nothing to fear," he said. "Let's get you up top. I've still got to get my gun."
I gripped the edge of the upper bunk, and he gave me a leg up, as if helping me mount a horse. I struggled to find my way under the covers, but the gas mask made it nearly impossible to tell what I was doing.
"I'll be right back," he said, ducking away.
I cried out, even tried to grab him, but a moment later he was gone. As even more aircraft zoomed overhead, I burst into tears, blubbering inside my gas mask. The gun must have been in the dugout, because he was back almost immediately.
"It's all right," he said, crouching by the flap. "It's just more Spitfires."
The siren was relentless, rising and falling, rising and falling, and after a few hours I grew numb to it, lulled into a stupor. I lay on my side, watching Angus the entire time. He kept his head slightly down, listening carefully. Each time a plane roared overhead, he shouted over to me, telling me what it was. I didn't know the difference between a Lockheed Lightning and a Bristol Blenheim, but decided that if Angus wasn't outside shooting at it, it probably wasn't going to drop a bomb on us. I grew so inured to the siren's wail, I was startled when it finally went steady, shrieking solidly at its highest note. When it tapered off and fell silent, Angus set his gun down.
"That's lots, I guess," he said, climbing to his feet.
He made his way toward the back of the shelter and dropped out of sight to check on Meg. A few seconds later, he reappeared, folding his forearms on the edge of the bunk and resting his chin on them. His face was right in front of the clear plastic window of my mask, and I realized he'd never put his on. He hadn't even brought it out. His arms had been full.
"You all right, then?" he asked.
I started to kick my way free of the covers.
"Stay put," he said. "Meg's asleep."
"We're spending the night out here?" I asked, my voice muffled by rubber.
"Aye, what's left of it. It'll be easier to navigate by the light of day, and I don't want to manhandle her again."
He tapped the window of my mask.
"You can take that off, you know."
When I removed it, he took it from me and leaned over to put it back in its ridiculous red case.
"Are you warm enough up there?" he asked.
"Yes, but where will you sleep?"
"I'll nip inside and get a quilt."
"Why don't you take the top bunk and I'll move down with Meg?"
"No, she's curled up and it would take some doing to rearrange her. We'll stay as we are."
"There's enough room up here for both of us," I said. He popped back up. Our eyes met, and this time there was no separation at all. No plastic windows, green canisters, black rubber, or anything else that might have disguised my words. I had no idea how they'd come out of my mouth. He smiled, and the skin beside his eyes crinkled. "I'm sorry," I said, aware that my cheeks were blazing. He held two fingers to my lips and slid his hand around until he was cupping my cheek. I gasped and turned into his hand, pressing my face against it and closing my eyes. When I opened them again, he was staring right through me. His eyes were as penetrating and startling as the first time I'd seen him.
"Hush, maiden," he said. "Everything's all right."
He pulled his hand free. "Where are you going?" I cried.
"Back in a jiffy,"
he said, slipping out of the shelter. He'd left the flashlight on. Connell was sitting by the entrance, his head bowed like a gargoyle. Angus returned with a quilt, which he wrapped around himself. He crouched against the wall by the entrance, and turned off the light.
Good night, maiden.
I reached up and traced the area of my face where he'd touched me. Chapter 36. On the ninth day, I began to wonder if something had happened to Ellis and Hank, and if so, would anyone know how to find me? On the 11th day, it dawned on me that they might not be planning to return. It started out as magical thinking, but I soon convinced myself it wasn't that outlandish. Ellis had no home or money to return to, whereas Hank had all the money in the world and would continue to have it wherever he was. They could change their identities, go somewhere exotic, find an opium den by the sea, leave the whole mess behind. I knew I was part of that mess, but if they really had run off together, never to return, why would they care what happened to me? Maybe they'd found some fondness for me after all, and had decided to set me free. Of course, I wouldn't really be free until I managed to make it legal, but the idea shone as brightly as a sliver of light beneath a prison door. I was sure Angus would let me stay on until the end of the war. I worked as hard as anyone, but it was more than that. I felt at home at the inn, even welcome. I couldn't bring myself to think beyond the war when the proprietor came back. My dearest hope, my deepest desire, was the one thing I couldn't let myself think about at all, in case I started to believe it was possible, because I knew it wasn't. On the 12th night of my husband's absence, I moved back into my room. It was mid-afternoon, and Anna and I were up in Meg's room. We were making ourselves scarce, because Rona was concocting yet another soup, this one with a base of mutton shanks and barley. Between them, Rona and Maher appeared to have laid out an exact plan for Meg's recovery, based on soup and tea. There were now four big pots simmering on the range, and they filled the entire building with an irresistible aroma. Apparently, it was not irresistible to Meg. The three of us were sprawled on her bed, playing hearts, when she wrinkled her nose and asked what the stink was. I told her about the new soup.
"Not Scotch broth," she wailed. "I haven't had real food in 2 weeks."
Anna and I glanced at each other. This was the first time Meg had shown an interest in any food since her injury, real or otherwise.
"I'll be right back," said Anna, leaping into action.
She returned shortly with a bowl of porridge and a coddled egg, both of them swimming in butter.
"I hope you enjoy it," she said,
handing the egg to Meg and putting the other bowl on the table.
"Because when Rona tells Maher, I'm done for."
"Why?" I asked.
"Because their prescription of the day is cockaliki, and no doubt I've undone all their good work."
"This is marvelous," said Meg,
her mouth full of egg.
"I don't suppose there's another."
"I'm afraid not, but I'll bring an egg a day from now on."
"And if the hens don't cooperate?" I asked.
"I'll pick them up and squeeze until an egg pops out," Anna said, making strangulation gestures with her hands.
"And if that doesn't work, I'll remind them what happened to Jenny."
"Who's Jenny?" I said.
"The hen in the soup." She stopped laying. "Do you want to know the name of the sheep and t'other?"
"No, I most certainly do not," I said.
"Elsie," said Anna. "She was a fine ewe. She'll also show up in potted hoch, mutton hot pot, and haggis. Oh, we'll be seeing Elsie for quite some time."
"Stop," I said, holding my hands over my ears. "I'll never be able to eat again."
"City folks," Anna said, shaking her head. "You never even met Elsie. I can see your cards, you know, when you tip them like that."
"Behave yourselves, the both of you," Meg said,
trying unsuccessfully not to laugh.
"My ribs, remember?"
"Sorry," Anna said in a sing-song voice. "It's not my fault if some people can't..."
There was a knocking on the door downstairs, a solemn, familiar rhythm. The three of us froze. My mind began to race. Meg had already lost everyone. Angus had already lost everyone.
"Robbie!"
Anna gasped, leaping from the bed. I scrambled after her and had just caught up when she yanked the front door open. Willie the postie was on the doorstep, holding his hat, along with a telegram. Anna slid silently to the floor. I dropped down beside her, wrapping my arms around her.
"Anna," Willie said quickly. "It's not for you."
"What?" she said, looking up at him with shocked eyes.
"It's not Robbie," said Willie. "The telegram is not for you."
Oh, she said.
Mrs. Hyde, said Willie, I am afraid it's for you.
I climbed to my feet, confused.
My deepest condolences, said Willie,
handing me the telegram. Anna got up and closed the door, even though Willie was still standing there. I walked to the couch and sat down. Anna sat next to me. The telegram was from a lawyer. My father had choked to death on a piece of steak 14 days earlier. The lawyer was sorry the notification was so late, but my whereabouts had been somewhat difficult to discern. I was to confirm whether this was indeed my current location, and if this was where I wished details to be sent. I set the piece of paper in my lap and looked blankly across the room. My father had died on the night Ellis tried to beat down my door, the night Rory nearly killed Meg. It was also the anniversary of Mari receiving the telegram that turned out to be the end of her. Marty, Anna said in a hushed voice. I handed it to her. Oh, Marty, she said after reading it. I don't know what to say. I'm so sorry. I'm so very, very sorry. Is there anything at all I can do? I think I need to be alone for a while. Of course, whatever you want. As I stood, she laid her hand on my arm. That was Valentine's Day, she said, her eyes opening wide. I know, I said. It must be cursed. I walked slowly along the A-82, stepping aside to wait as an impossibly long line of moss-colored military vehicles rolled past. They were lumbering and square-faced, the first dozen or so with tarps tied over their loads, and the rest transporting soldiers. Men from every vehicle leaned out the open backs, hanging by one arm to whistle and make catcalls. More than a few made vulgar comments, but there was no way I could escape their attentions. I was trapped at the side of the road. I turned to face the oncoming vehicles, because then I didn't have to see the men's leering expressions. The drivers also looked at me, but they were behind glass, so I couldn't hear what they said. Finally, I saw the end of the line. In all, 28 vehicles had driven past. I wondered how many of the young men would come back alive from wherever it was they were being sent. I kept walking. The clouds were an intense gray, surging and changing, and appearing in some places to roll out of crevices in the hills themselves. It was astonishing how little it took for the same landscape to take on a completely different cast. The hills, with their fields and forests, were alternately bleak, looming, rugged, or majestic, depending on what the sky above them was doing. At that moment, they looked aptly funereal. It must have seemed strange to Anna that I did not cry. Perhaps she thought I was having a delayed reaction. I considered the possibility, but dismissed it almost immediately. I wondered if he'd been eating in his study when the meat lodged in his windpipe, or if he'd gone back to taking his meals in the dining room. Had he made any noise, or was he completely silent? Perhaps he'd turned purple and staggered around trying to summon help. Perhaps he'd simply fallen face down into a spinach souffle. I pictured these scenarios with morbid curiosity, but not sorrow, and definitely not grief. Although his letter to me had removed all doubt, I think I'd always known that he didn't love me, and apparently his lack of affection had engendered the same in me. There'd been a dearth of affection all around. My mother certainly hadn't loved me, despite her extravagant claims. Her affections, such as they were, vaporized entirely during the 7 weeks she was on the run with Arthur, and returned, redoubled, only when she was forced to go back to my father. Ellis had also never loved me, at least not as a husband should love his wife, and recently not at all. I reached the castle. Although I hadn't consciously chosen it as a destination, I climbed up and through the dry moat and across the interior grounds without hesitation. I found myself standing at the opening to the water gate. I picked my way down the hill, which was steep enough that toward the bottom I ended up in a graceless gallop to keep from losing my balance. In the scrub to the side of the landing, there were dozens upon dozens of cigarette butts. I was heartsick at the thought of Hank and Ellis setting up on the very spot from which Mari had stepped to her death, drinking, smoking, and swearing, oblivious to everyone but themselves and their future fame. I stepped forward, as Mari once had,
until my feet were at the water's edge. I took another step, just a little one, so that the soles of my shoes were submerged. I watched the water swirl around them, then looked up at the lock itself, black and rolling, endlessly deep. What had Mari's thoughts been as she walked in? When it was too late to turn back, when the water closed over her, had she regretted it or felt relief, believing that she was about to be reunited with her husband and child? I opened my mind, trying to channel her. I wanted to know what it was like to experience a love so deep you couldn't bear to exist without it. I felt her then. I felt Mari and the cavernous depths of her grief, and had an overwhelming urge to keep going, to walk into the lock. Her anguish was boundless, her sorrow without end. I was drowning in it. We were drowning in it. I closed my eyes, lifted my arms, and let myself fall. A deep rumbling started in the water, like something was rising, followed by a great whoosh as it broke the surface. I opened my eyes, still falling, no way to stop then, and saw two blades of water curling from the edges of a channel that was being cut. But by what? Something was obviously racing across the surface of the water, but it looked like nothing was there. Before I could make any sense of it, the thing struck me in the abdomen, folding me around it and knocking me backward. I landed away from the water's edge, banging my head so hard, my peripheral vision filled with tiny, sparkling stars. Although the wind had been knocked out of me, I staggered to my feet. The surface of the lock was smooth, the stones on the landing dry. There was no sign even of a dissipating wake. I scrambled up the hill, grabbing tufts of grass to speed my ascent. Only when I reached the top did I pause to catch my breath. I leaned against the inside of the ancient arch, periodically looking back at the lock and trying unsuccessfully to calm myself. Chapter 37. If Willie the Postie was surprised by my disheveled state when I entered his post office and asked about the possibility of making a transatlantic phone call, he didn't betray it. It was, after all, mere hours since he delivered the news of my father's death. He explained that overseas calls were by radio only and that the equipment was at the big house. "Thank you," I said, putting my gloves back on.
"And where do you think you're going?" he demanded, angling his eyebrows fiercely.
"To the big house," I said. He raised a hand.
"I'm afraid that's absolutely out of the question. The equipment is strictly for military use. No exceptions. It's not like a telephone box, you know. And anyway, you can't just go mucking about on the grounds of a battle school."
"No, of course not. I wasn't thinking."
"You'll be sending a telegram, then?"
I cast him an embarrassed look. "I would, but I'm afraid my situation hasn't changed."
"Ah," he said, nodding. "Under the circumstances, I think I can overlook the fee."
"Thank you," I said. "That's very kind. I'll do my best to keep it short, but I'm afraid it might end up being rather long anyway."
"I quite understand," he said, preparing to take my dictation.
And I think he did understand, right up to the part where I asked the lawyer to please let me know what was involved in getting a divorce and whether I could do so from Scotland, and to please respond by either telegram or airmail, since I wished to settle both matters as quickly as possible. Willie understood that part, too, but it was a different type of understanding, one not tempered by empathy. His entire bearing hardened. Despite the warnings, I couldn't help myself. I had to see Craggarv. I had no illusions about getting inside the big house. I just wanted to lay eyes on the place. It was where Angus had lived before the war and still spent his days. It was where he took the game and fish so many villagers depended on to supplement their rations. It was where the colonel had made such a nuisance of himself all those years ago, causing the international scandal that eventually led to Alice and Hank deciding we had no choice but to find the monster ourselves. It was the nucleus of everything. There were no signs to direct me, although there were posts with holes in them where signs used to be, so I walked the periphery of the village until I found a dirt road that led into the forest. Because of my experience at the cover, I took a moment to note where the sun was as well as the relative positions of the hills before winding my way in. Ancient rhododendrons began dotting the side of the road, the tips of their droopy leaves pulled toward the earth by the weight of snow, but already bearing buds for the coming spring. In one clearing, a constellation of purple crocuses poked defiantly through the crusted ice. About 3/4 of a mile in, I caught my first glimpse of the house. I could see it only in bits and pieces, because the road was still twisting its way around, and many of the trees between the house and me were coniferous. Still, I got an immediate sense of its scope. I hurried around the bend to see more. The road grew wider, and the thicket beside it disappeared, turning quite suddenly into a formal approach lined by 100-year oaks. I stayed back in the shadow of the woods. I was no stranger to large houses, but this was enormous. From counting windows, I could see that the center of the house had at least 4 main stories, and the end towers even more. I could not begin to count the chimneys. I started at one end and lost track at 16 before I even reached the center. Semicircular staircases with stone balustrades approached the main door from both sides, and another row of balustrades graced the roof's parapet. This was no house. This was a castle. The entire front garden, or what had been the front garden, was enclosed in barbed wire fencing and crammed with row upon row of corrugated metal shacks. They looked like Anderson shelters, only much larger. An enormous stone fountain, dry of course, rose from the center. The fountain looked to be from the Baroque period, with 3 or 4 human forms kneeling under an enormous vessel. I crept up behind a large yew to get a better look, and tripped on an exposed root. I fell forward, catching myself on the tree's rough trunk. Only then did I see the sign nailed to it, directly above my hand. It was bright red and triangular, with a white skull and crossbones on top, and a single word across the bottom, Minefield. I froze. My right foot was still partially on the root, leaving me precariously balanced. With my hand still firmly planted on the trunk, I looked down, studying my feet and the ground around me, wondering if there was any way at all of knowing where a mine might be buried. A spurt of gunfire crackled in the distance, underscored by male voices, bellowing, primitive, and fierce. I hadn't moved, was still standing with one foot teetering on the root and my hand braced against the trunk, when another round of gunfire went off, answered by a volley from a different, much closer location. I think I screamed. I'm not sure, but certainly my careless attitude toward live ammunition had been replaced by sheer terror. Tracer bullets at night were one thing. Minefields and machine guns were quite another. I was carrying my red gas mask case and wearing my red gloves, which would either make me visible enough that no one would shoot me accidentally, or else would make me an easy target. Guided by sheer instinct, I twisted away from the tree and leapt toward the road in long strides. My feet landed in a thick carpet of leaves 3 times before I reached it, and each time I was sure I was going to be blown to smithereens. When I found myself safely back on the road, I went completely still. I wondered if I'd been walking in a minefield the entire time, and how the hell I was going to escape. As shots continued to ring out in the forest around me, my eyes lit on tire tracks. I hopped into a rut and stayed carefully within it, placing each foot directly in front of the other. By the time I passed the last of the ancient rhododendrons, I was running flat out. My gas mask bounced behind me, hitting me in the back with every stride. I stumbled out of the woods and onto the street, my legs pinwheeling as though someone had shoved me from behind. I went straight over the white-painted curb and crashed into the low stone wall beyond it. I leaned against it, doubled over and wheezing, as a red cow with very long hair and even longer horns gazed placidly at me, chewing its cud. Meg was standing by the end of the bar when I burst through the door and slammed it behind me.
"Maddy, whatever's the matter?"
I peeled off my gloves, but my hands were shaking so hard I dropped them. When I leaned over to pick them up, my gas mask slipped off my shoulder and landed on the floor with a thunk.
"Leave them," Meg said. "Come sit."
I left everything and wobbled over to the couch. I sat on the very edge and reached up to feel my hair, which was plastered to my forehead and neck. Meg looked anxiously at the door.
Why were you running? Is someone chasing you?
I waved vigorously, still out of breath.
No, no, it's nothing like that. Don't worry.
She looked at the door one more time, then sat gingerly beside me.
Then what is it?
Nothing, I said.
It's clearly something. You're all worked up. Wait here. I'll get a glass of water.
Please don't get up, I said. What are you doing down here, anyway? You're not supposed to exert yourself.
I'm hardly exerting myself. I needed a change of scenery, so I brought down the crossword puzzles you gave me. Stay where you are. I'm fetching some water, and I'll have no arguments about it, either.
I gulped it down noisily as soon as she handed it to me, not even lowering the glass when I had to pause for breath. When it was empty, I set it down and wiped my mouth with the back of my hand.
Thank you, I said, glancing over in embarrassment.
I found Meg gazing at me with a combination of sympathy and sadness.
Anna told me about your father, she said quietly.
I'm very sorry for your loss. It's perfectly natural to be rattled. You never know how you're going to react to news like that.
It's not my father, I said. I don't care about my father.
Meg watched me for almost a full minute. I realized how awful what I just said sounded, and wondered if she thought me heartless.
Then what is it? She inquired carefully.
I let out a desperate, nervous laugh.
I'm not sure I should tell you. Rest assured I'll not be judging, she said. I'm hardly in a position to cast stones.
You're going to think I'm crazy.
Well, I won't know until you tell me.
I leaned in closer.
I was attacked by the monster today.
Meg's eyes widened. After a brief pause, she said,
You were what?
I threw myself against the back of the couch.
I knew you'd think I was crazy. I didn't believe in any of this supernatural stuff before I came here. Then the König came for Anna's brother. There was never any doubt in Anna's mind that she'd come for Hugh, and she was right. And that damnable crow signaling sorrow and chasing me into the cover. And today, the monster, it rose straight out of the water and attacked me.
Meg stared at me for several seconds, then got to her feet.
I think we could both use something a wee bit stronger.
She poured two small whiskies and brought them over.
Sláinte, she said.
Sláinte, I said, clinking my glass against hers.
All right, then, she said. How about you go back to the beginning?
I didn't know how far back she wanted me to go, so I started at the actual beginning, blurting out everything and barely pausing for breath. Everything, from how I felt nothing about my father's death, because he had been completely indifferent to my existence, to my mother starving me for years, to her plans for fixing my nose and scrambling my frontal lobe, to the suicide attempt that I was supposed to foil, to discovering that Hank and Ellis had tossed a coin to see who had to marry me, and now had abandoned me completely, to my belief that Ellis wasn't colorblind after all, to realizing I was crushingly in love with Angus, to my alarming experience at the bottom of the Watergate, to sending a telegram to the lawyer asking how to go about getting a divorce, and finally, to wandering into a minefield, because for whatever reason, the big house held some kind of gravitational pull I couldn't resist. In the dead silence that followed, I realized what I'd done.
Oh, God, I said, clapping my hands to my face. If you're talking about Angus, it's hardly a surprise, Meg said. I've seen how you look at him.
I turned away, panting through steepled fingers.
And I've seen how he looks at you, too, she added quietly.
My heart either skipped a beat or took an extra one. I lowered my hands and turned back around. She was staring straight into my eyes.
Go back a wee bit. Tell me exactly what happened at the water's edge.
I told her again.
And then, just as I was about to hit the water, it was like a boulder of air exploded from the surface, knocking me backward. I know how crazy it sounds, but it's the God's honest truth, even though I can't explain any of it.
Meg nodded knowingly, solemnly.
Aye, but I can. It wasn't the monster, Matty. If it had been, it wouldn't have pushed you away. It would have dragged you in.
I shook my head.
But then what? It was Mari, Meg said. She died 3 years ago today, at that very place. She entered your head and your heart to see if you'd be true to Angus, and when she saw that you would be, she pushed you to safety. Maddie, she gave you her blessing.
Chapter 38. In the space of one day, I'd gone from thinking that no one in the world had ever loved me to thinking that the man I was hopelessly in love with might feel the same way about me. It was more than just that, though. The ghostly intervention gave me hope that we were meant to be together. After the König, I was no longer inclined to ignore such a message. Meg wanted to return to work that night, just to lend a hand, but Angus was having none of it. I had to agree. She'd only just had her stitches out, and I still caught her wincing when she thought no one was looking. Still, I was sorry she wasn't going to be there, because I felt in need of moral support. A few minutes before 6, when I took my place behind the bar, Angus came up beside me and laid a hand on mine.
I heard about your father. I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you, I said, looking up at him. And I, for yours. He nodded slowly, and that was it. He knew I knew everything. As the evening wore on, I watched Angus's face, hoping for a sign that Meg's words were true. But he was understandably preoccupied, his expression unreadable. It was clear that the local men also remembered the anniversary, for they placed their orders solemnly and with diffidence. The only chatter was at the tables of lumberjacks, some of whom had brought their fiancés. At one point, when I was sprinting into the kitchen with a stack of empty plates, I ran straight into Angus. He caught my elbows to steady me.
"You all right?" he asked.
"Yes," I said, in a pathetic attempt to sound casual. "Not sure about the front of my dress, though." He stared down at me, his eyes intense and unblinking. For the longest time, neither one of us moved. When he finally stepped around me and returned to the front room, I dropped the stack of plates onto the table and leaned against it. When the front door opened and closed for the last time and Meg had gone to bed, I crept down the stairs as quietly as a cat. I had prepared myself like a bride, brushing my hair until it was soft, rubbing scented lotion into my hands and elbows, and donning a long white nightgown, modest but with lace at the neck and on the ends of the sleeves. The fire had been smored and cast but the faintest glow. The flagstone floor was cold beneath my feet, and I almost lost my nerve. I stood with both hands on the bar, gathering courage. If I turned back, it would be like nothing had ever happened. If I kept going, I would be stepping into the great unknown. Maddie, she gave you her blessing. I slipped into the kitchen and felt my way along the wall until I found one of the carved wooden doors that slid shut in front of his bed. In the darkness, I couldn't tell if they were open or closed. I let my fingers crawl along the wood until I reached the far edge. The doors were open. I was standing right in front of him. I found myself in a beam of blinding light and jumped backward. When Angus saw it was me, he leaned the flashlight against the wall so it was aimed at the ceiling instead, and swung his legs around. He was wearing blue-striped pajama bottoms and an undershirt, just as he had on the night of our arrival.
"What's going on? Is everything all right?" he said, rubbing his eyes.
"Everything's fine," I said, blinking quickly. The flashlight's glare had left two white spots in the center of my vision.
"Then what is it?"
I dropped my gaze and bit my lip. After the better part of a minute, when the blind spots had mostly gone away, I forced myself to look up again. He was watching me with obvious concern.
"What is it, maiden?"
he asked gently. I steeled myself. "Angus, there's something I want to... No, something I need to tell you. Something important." I swallowed loudly and looked directly into his eyes. "I know the situation is unusual, and that under any other circumstances, none of this would make sense. But nothing about our circumstances is normal, and I've come to realize that I have... I clapped my hands over my mouth to stifle a cry. "Oh, God,
I'm so sorry. I've never felt so stupid in all my life.
In a flash, he was up and I was in his arms.
Hush, Mabel. You don't have to say a thing. I already know.
But how can you know if I can't even manage to tell you? I sobbed.
Because I just do, he said.
His heart went thumpity, thumpity, thump, inches from my ear. Eventually he pulled back, keeping his hands on my shoulders. He stared into my eyes and held my gaze until there was nothing on earth but his face. When he put his hands on my cheeks and leaned toward me, my legs almost abandoned me. I closed my eyes and let my lips part. He kissed my forehead.
Maiden, you're grieving, he said quietly. You're vulnerable. This is not the time for such things.
I don't know how I made it upstairs. Certainly quickly and certainly not gracefully. And when I finally reached my bed, I blubbered shamelessly, burying my face in the pillow. There was a quiet knock on the door. Even though my sobs had subsided into quiet weeping, my ignominious retreat had certainly been loud enough to wake Meg.
"It's not locked," I said.
The door opened, and the light of a candle cast long shadows at the far end of the room. Judging by its silhouette, the chair was almost as tall as the ceiling. I lay facing it, my knees folded nearly to my chest, my face and pillow wet with tears.
"Sorry I woke you up," I mumbled.
"I'm not," said Angus.
I jerked my head off the pillow and looked behind me. He was standing in the doorway, holding the candle.
"May I come in?"
I pulled myself upright, sliding backward until I was against the headboard. I sniffed and wiped my face with shaking hands. He set the candle on the dresser and crossed the floor to the bed.
"Forgive me," he said.
I stared at him, trembling. Fresh tears rolled down my face. He sat on the bed and ran a thumb across my cheek. I held my breath and closed my eyes.
"Forgive me," he said again.
When I opened my eyes, I was looking directly into his.
"I was wrong, Morun. This is exactly the right time."
He shifted closer and began kissing the tears from my cheeks in a slow, tender dance that moved from one side of my face to the other. Finally, when I thought I couldn't stand it any longer, he put his lips on mine. They were warm and full and slightly parted, and I felt the quickness of his breath behind them. He kissed me over and over, with increasing urgency, his beard brushing against my skin. His hand slid down my neck and into my nightgown. I gasped, and he stopped. With his hand cupping my breast, he searched my face for a signal. It was a moment of excruciating sweetness, of torturous rapture, of exquisite need. It was unbearable. I leaned forward, tugging at his shirt. He stood and pulled it over his head. I knelt on the bed, yanking at my nightgown.
"Wait,"
he said. And this time I was the one who stopped. He removed my nightgown, slowly, reverently. I had never felt so exposed, yet I didn't want to cover myself. The candlelight flickered behind him, and his breathing grew even heavier as his eyes traveled over my body, resting without shame on my breasts and hips.
"Morun Gialog," he said. "So beautiful."
He untied his pajamas and let them drop to the floor. I caught my breath. I obviously knew the anatomy, but other than statues, I'd never seen a naked man, never mind an aroused one. Angus seemed to sense that, and paused, giving me a chance to look. Finally, he knelt on the bed and put a hand behind my neck, supporting my head as he guided me backward. Moments later, when he was poised above me, he looked deep into my eyes and said,
"You're sure, Mokria, for this cannot be undone."
"Yes," I whispered. "I am completely and absolutely sure." When he sank into me, I was so lost my body began to quake. I wrapped my arms and legs around him, holding on for dear life. The next morning, it took me a moment to realize I wasn't dreaming. The candle had long since burned out, so we were in cave-like darkness, side by side, our naked bodies pressed together. He had one arm under my pillow and the other across me, his hand resting between my breasts. I lay very still, with my hands on his forearm. When he stirred, I clasped his hand to my heart and ran my fingers up his arm, marveling at our different textures. Although he was still asleep, a pulsing nudge intensified until the length of him was pressed against my back. I rolled over and pulled the sheets down, kissing his chest and tracing his scars with my lips and fingers. When I finally worked my way up to his mouth, he took my face in his hands and pressed his lips against mine, parting them so we shared the same breath. A moment later, he lifted me across him like I weighed nothing, setting me down so my knees were on either side of him. I put both hands on his abdomen to brace myself, more than a little shocked to find myself straddling him. He reached up and ran his thumbs over my nipples. I sucked in my breath and almost didn't let it out again.
"Marty, Mokria," he said.
"Angus, oh my God," I said in a broken voice. "I don't know what to do."
"You do, though. Let yourself come to me."
I lowered my hips slowly and stopped breathing altogether when I felt the tip of him pressing against me. "Angus."
"It's all right," he said, stroking my face. "Nastad, I'm right here with you."
He held himself steady while I took him into me, slowly, slowly, sliding down until he was buried so deep our hips met, then lifting myself up until I was afraid I might lose him, then sinking back down until we were joined again. I leaned forward and put my hands on either side of his head, breathing hard into the pillow beside his face. He had his hands on my waist, and his hips rose a little higher each time I sank down, pushing myself deeper and staying there longer. I felt his blood pounding as if our nerve endings had merged. My legs were shaking violently, and just when I thought I was going to lose control entirely, he reached up and clasped my hands, intertwining our fingers, and guaranteed it. The contractions overwhelmed me, so unexpected and intense, I cried out, and he held my face, covering my mouth with his, pressing into me faster, more urgently. When I felt his own surrender, I was shot through with an ecstasy so intense, I thought my heart might actually stop. After, as we lay in each other's arms, he stroked my hair and back. My face was buried in his neck, and every breath I took was suffused with his scent.
"Well,"
he said, kissing me,
"I'm afraid that while I'd love to stay here forever, duty calls."
I caught his wrist. "I love you, Angus Grant. With all my heart, I love you." He leaned over and gave me a long, lingering kiss.
"And I you, Mokria."
Chapter 39 Meg knew exactly what had happened the second she laid eyes on me. She said nothing, just smiled in a knowing manner. It didn't help that I blushed and looked at the ground, or that I was wearing a turban because I hadn't set my hair. I finished the upstairs chores at about the same time Anna finished the downstairs, and the three of us wound up around the kitchen table having a strupach. Anna had spent the last few afternoons clearing rocks from the tatty beds at the croft and was suffering from a stiff back.
"It's the buckets of stones," she explained. "They weigh more than buckets of milk, and you're always picking them up and putting them down and then leaning over to collect even more. It's murder on the back, I tell you. I'll look like Rona when all is said and done."
"Of course you won't," I said, although not as convincingly as I wished. Crofting sounded like a very hard life indeed.
"Stand up and lean over the table," Meg said. "I'll work those knots out for you."
Meg stood behind her and massaged Anna's back, digging her thumbs into the areas just above Anna's hips.
"I'll come help with the stones," said Meg. "Many hands make light work."
"I should think not," Anna said with righteous indignation. "Dr. McLean has not cleared you for any type of work yet, especially not clearing rocks."
"Well, I can't just do nothing, can I?" said Meg. "I'm sick to death of Maddie's crossword puzzles and their fiendish American spelling. Why would anyone put an E in whiskey, for goodness sake? Anyway, Dr. McLean is going to clear me for work any day now, which probably means I'm already perfectly capable."
Maybe I can help clear stones, I said. Anna and Meg looked at me, deadpan. A couple of seconds later, they burst out laughing.
And get your hands dirty, Meg practically crowed.
I get my hands dirty all the time. I didn't see you offering to help clean the range this morning, said Anna.
You didn't ask, I said. And for your information, I was upstairs scrubbing the toilet. I didn't see you offer with that, either.
Oh, go on, said Anna. We're just having a little fun.
I know that, I said, laughing. Don't be silly.
Anna narrowed her eyes and looked me up and down.
You're in a very good mood this morning.
The front door opened, and after a few seconds it closed. Anna glanced at the clock.
That'll be Willie with the mail, she said in a panic. And here I am, all covered with soot and oven blocking.
Grab a cloth and clean yourself up, said Meg. I'll stall him.
Willie was expected to pop the question at any moment, having already asked permission from Anna's father. It was a mystery to me what the attraction was. It was easy to see why Willie was attracted to Anna, but what did Anna see in Willie? He had always struck me as an angry orange gnome who was quick to judge and was also a good 20 years older than she was, but apparently she was madly in love with him. I supposed there was no accounting for Cupid's aim. I felt sorry for poor one-legged George, though. Anna ran to the sink and began scrubbing her face. I followed to make sure she didn't miss a spot. Meg returned, pale as beeswax.
"It's not Willie," she said.
"Then who?" I asked.
Meg looked despondently at me, and I knew.
"Dear God in heaven," I said.
Meg stepped forward and squeezed my hands.
"He's not asked for you yet. When he does, I'll tell him you've gone walking."
"No," I said quietly. "I'll go out. There's no point in delaying the inevitable."
"What are you going to tell him?" Meg asked.
"I have no idea."
"At the very least, wait until Angus comes back."
I shook my head. Meg watched me for a beat, then nodded.
"All right, but I'll be standing right here with the heaviest saucepan we have, should you find yourself in need of assistance."
I pulled my apron over my head and hung it on a peg. Then I walked through to the front room, my legs seeming to move of their own accord. Ellis and Hank were settled by the fire in their usual places, as though they'd never been gone at all. Ellis sat on the couch with his back to me, and Hank sat in one of the wing chairs. He stood at once.
"Maddie, darling girl," he said,
raising his arms in welcome. When I didn't respond, he dropped them and frowned.
"What's the matter? You look like you've seen a ghost."
"I feel rather as though I have. What are you doing here?" Ellis shifted around to face me, draping his arm across the back of the couch.
"That's an odd question. We're staying here, of course."
"Well, no. In fact, you haven't been."
"You knew we were going away," said Ellis.
"You said you'd be gone a few days," I said. "It's been 2 weeks."
13 days, said Hank. "But who's counting?"
"I was," I said. "I didn't think you were coming back."
"Oh, dear, you didn't think I'd abandoned you again, did you?" said Ellis.
He raised an eyebrow and turned to Hank, adding,
"I told you, she has quite an imagination."
My knees buckled. A moment later, Hank and Ellis were steering me toward the couch.
"What's the matter? Are you having an episode?" said Ellis.
"Get her a glass of water," said Hank.
"I can't," Ellis replied. "There's no one behind the bar."
"Then get a glass and find a sink."
"You mean in the kitchen? What if the hag's in there?"
"Then use the bathroom, for Christ's sake."
Ellis glanced at Hank in a wounded manner, then went behind the bar for a glass. After pausing at the door to the kitchen, he changed his mind and went upstairs. Hank perched on the low table in front of me. He leaned forward, resting his forearms on his thighs.
"Darling girl, what's going on? Talk to me."
"There's nothing going on," I said, although my voice betrayed me.
"It's not nothing, obviously. And if you don't tell me what's going on, he's going to think you're having an episode."
I couldn't help laughing. "He always thinks I'm having an episode. I don't care anymore."
"You don't mean that," said Hank.
"Oh, but I do."
"Fuck," Hank said.
He glanced quickly at the stairwell.
"Look, I think you should know that Ellis has been making inquiries. Actually, more than inquiries. Arrangements.
So he's really going to try to have me locked up, is he?
No, he's going to have you treated.
I was shocked into momentary silence.
Treated? I asked in a hollow voice, although of course I already knew. Given the severity of your symptoms, the physician he spoke to thought a permanent cure was the best solution. You wouldn't even have to stay in the hospital.
You'll be so much happier, my mother had said. An easy thing. In and out in an hour. And what did Alice say to the doctor to make him think that?
Well, for starters, that you flushed your medication.
I flushed the pills because Alice was eating them hand over fist. I've had one pill in my life. One pill. He's always been the one who took them. Hank, you know that.
You've lost all sense of social structure. You're showing signs of paranoia.
Paranoia? Really, Hank?
And you've begun having delusions.
I stared at him and began nodding. So that's what this is really about.
What?
As if you don't know. I'm sending a telegram to the colonel this very minute.
Saying what? Hank asked.
That Ellis isn't colorblind. That he lied to get out of service. Hank went slack-jawed.
Maddie, my God! Of course he's not faking it. That's a terrible thing to say.
Oh, please, I said. How stupid do you think I am? You obviously planned it together, finding conveniently invisible ailments to keep you out of the war.
What are you talking about?
Flat-footed? Please. Hank sputtered in outrage.
I am flat-footed. I've been wearing custom shoes my entire life.
You're each as bad as the other. I've had it. I stood up.
Maddie, stop.
He said it with enough conviction that I did.
Don't do it, he said.
Why? There will be no point in having me treated once everyone knows the truth.
Because it's not the truth. And this is exactly the type of rash behavior Ellis is worried about. You get something in your head, and then you act on it without any regard for consequence, no matter who it damages. If you send a telegram to the colonel, Ellis will just have you treated sooner rather than later. It's all been arranged. He only has to make a phone call. And then, for good measure, he'll probably have Blackbeard hauled off as well.
Angus, why?
Because of exactly that, the unsuitable familiarity. Ellis is sure he's been taking advantage of you, so he stopped by the courthouse to check the penalty for poaching. It's 2 years in prison per offense, by the way.
I sat back down slowly. So if it's a phone call away and there's nothing I can do, why are you even telling me? I asked. Hank sighed.
I don't know. I guess because it is a phone call away. To warn you, I suppose, so you can try not to set him off. I was initially against the whole idea, but I have to be honest. Maddie, you're scaring me. Do you realize what you just accused me of? What you just accused Ellis of? It's like you consciously came up with the one thing that would hurt us the most. That's not like you. The Maddie I know wouldn't do that.
Ellis came thumping back downstairs.
Here,
he said, pressing a glass of water into my hands. I pushed it back at him, spilling some onto his pants. He set the glass on the table and gazed at me with exaggerated concern.
Darling, you look rattled. Do you need a pill? I picked some up while we were gone. Found a very nice doctor, top of his field.
And then I knew it was true. I could see it running behind his eyes like a ticker tape, the false and self-serving concern that he would eventually convince himself was genuine, his enormous and growing satisfaction that I was, indeed, acting hysterically, along with his rewriting of history, so that he'd only ever done what was necessary for my happiness, because it was all he'd ever cared about. It was like he was channeling my mother. I realized how much now hinged on my behavior, and did my best to channel her, too. No, I just have a bit of a stomach bug, I said. I've been queasy all day. If you'll excuse me, I think I'll go lie down for a bit.
Do you want me to come with you?
He asked, using the same unctuous tone. No, I'm sure I'll be fine.
Maddie, he asked, were you in the kitchen just now when we came back?
Yes, I said, forcing a brief smile. I was looking for something to settle my stomach.
Ah, he said, nodding. Of course.
I'll come down at 7, shall I?
Only if you feel up to it, he said. Try to get some rest, darling.
I rose in as dignified a manner as I could, and somehow made it up the stairs. Meg showed up within minutes. I opened the door, then collapsed face down on my bed.
"What's going on?" she said, closing the door. "You should have spoken louder. We couldn't hear a thing."
"Bolt that, please," I said. She locked the door and sat beside me.
"What happened? Did you tell him you were ending it?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because I can't," I said miserably. "I have to reconcile with Alice, or at least pretend to." Meg jumped off the bed and spun angrily toward me.
"What? How could you? Do you have any idea what this will do to Angus? Does he mean that little to you?"
"No, he means that much to me," I whisper shouted. "And if I ever do have a chance at a future with him, I'd like my brain intact." Meg stared at me for a while, then sat back down.
"I don't think I follow," she said.
"Do you remember when I told you my mother wanted me to have a lobotomy?"
"Yes,"
she said doubtfully. "Do you know what a lobotomy is?"
"No, not exactly."
"They put a tiny spatula up through your eye socket into the front part of your brain and then twirl it around a bit. And that's exactly what my husband is going to have done to me the next time I do anything to upset him." Her mouth opened in horror.
"But surely he can't do that."
"It appears he can, since he's got it all arranged. I was diagnosed with a nervous ailment a few years ago, and my mother was entirely nuts. Alice sold the doctor on the idea without the doctor ever laying eyes on me. All Alice has to do is make a phone call, and they'll come cart me off."
"Dear Lord in heaven," said Meg.
She got up and walked stiffly to the chair.
"And you didn't tell him you asked about a divorce?"
"No, thank goodness. If I had, the ambulance would already be on its way."
"And he doesn't know about you and Angus?"
"He suspects something, but certainly not the full extent of it." She slapped the arms of the chair, startling me.
"Then why?"
"Money, of course," I said. "And the really stupid thing is that I brought all of this on myself."
"No," she said, frowning. "How could you have?"
"I was stupid enough to let him know that I don't believe he's colorblind. If I tell his father, he'll cut him off without a penny. So he's come up with a plan that lets him dismiss anything I say as crazy talk. And, of course, if I were ever foolish enough to open my mouth, he'll make the phone call and take care of the problem. The only thing I can do is try not to upset him until I figure something out."
"No, this is what we're going to do," Meg said firmly. "We're going to get you out of here. Anna's family will have you, I'm sure of that. Angus will spirit you over later."
"It wouldn't work. He'd find me."
"We'll make sure he doesn't."
"He'd find me and have the rest of you arrested for kidnapping. And, of course, I'd be delivered to a hospital in the back of an ambulance and come back drooling. Drooling, but ever so obedient."
"But you can't just sit around waiting for it to happen," Meg said angrily. "It makes no sense."
"You don't understand. He'd find me. There's too much money involved. His own family's fortune is big, but sooner or later, he's going to find out that my father is dead, and there's an obscene amount of money at stake there." Meg fell quiet for long enough that I finally turned back to her. Her pale eyes bored through me. She sighed and turned away from me, staring into the empty grate. She obviously knew there was more to it, but what could I tell her? That there was nothing anyone could do to save me that wouldn't land Angus in prison for life? That his fate lay in the hands of my volatile, feckless husband, and in my attempts to pacify him? After more than a minute, she began tapping a finger against her chin.
"Well," she said, "it's just possible there's another way."
For the first time since flopping on the bed, I pulled myself upright.
"What? What is it?" "Fiddlehead stew is a delicacy around here. Very tasty indeed, especially with a few drops of malt vinegar. Of course, you have to be very careful not to cook it too late in the season, or you risk bracken poisoning."
Her eyes cut sideways at me to see if I was following.
"But I suppose if the shoots were just a little bit iffy, maybe a week or two older than someone might usually use them, and an experienced cook might decide they were still safe. And then somebody else might see the pot boiling, and, knowing that it was too late in the season to be cooking fiddleheads, come to the conclusion that someone was boiling up a batch of insecticide for the vegetable garden. And to be helpful, she might throw in a few rhubarb leaves. I blinked a few times.
I don't think I can do that, I finally